Okay, today is March 15th, 2011. This is an interview with Bruce Fritz. We are here in the conference room inside the UW-Madison Archives, which is inside Steinbach Memorial Library. My name is Troy Reeves, and I am with the UW-Madison Archives. Bruce, if you wouldn't mind by starting by saying your name first and last, and then spelling your last name.
Bruce Fritz, F-R-I-T-Z.
Great, thank you. Bruce, we were chatting before we turned the microphone on, and that's where I found out that you went to school here in the mid-60s. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, the first question is, why go to school at UW-Madison?
I wanted to be a neurosurgeon, and it was in a pre-med course, basically, or track. I grew up in Monona, so contiguous to Madison, and this is always on my plan, part of my plan. So
where did you, or I guess I should say, why neurosurgery?
Because, I wanted to be a doctor, and then Ben Casey was a TV show at the time, and Dr. Zorba was Ben's mentor, and just I love that show. And it's kind of like House is now, only much tamer in those days, but everything ultimately led to something involving neurology, so that was what I wanted to do. And until I was a second semester sophomore, I can't remember exactly when, in 67, I bought two cameras and three lenses from a neighbor and fell in love with photography, and that's all I've done since. So
that was your junior year in college?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Actually, it's probably my sophomore year at that point. Okay. And in those days, you would, the draft was out, and if you didn't enlist, you were going to be drafted. And I very much was against the war and wanted no part of it. Debated leaving the country, didn't have enough guts quite to do that. I ended up enlisting in the Navy, think I would do the least damage and be safest. Ended up key punching on an aircraft carrier. And I was a seaman, data processing seaman, and I'd been weekend supervisor at the computing center at the university. And for a couple of years already at that point, so I was in charge of about $15 million worth of equipment and a dozen people, and could program in some basic languages, and was told by the Navy that I'd be probably programming in a shore base somewhere, and literally ended up key punching on an aircraft carrier. Hmm. So that was one of the more interesting and worst experiences of my life, personally. After 6 months out at sea, I got a hardship honorable discharge. It's a long story, not worth going into, involving my ex-wife now and some other things. But the happiest day of my life is when I got out of the Navy. So
was that earlier? You said you had a hiatus in between your time here on campus. Was that why?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. And then when I came back, I went back to school. And eventually, I was a second semester junior when I dropped out, because I got a job at the Capital Times and was a full-time staff photographer from June 1st of 69 through October 1st, 77, when we went on strike.
And I might actually, if we get a chance, it has nothing to do with Sterling Hall and student protests, but I might ask you about that, because I've interviewed a couple of people who were involved on the strike newspaper.
Okay.
Let's make sure we get these dates on the recording record.
Sure.
So can you give me again your two separate dates that you matriculated here?
Well, we came to school right out of high school, so it would have been in June, or actually September of 65 would have been when I started here at the university. I graduated from Rona Grove High School in 65. And then was back here. I think it was probably again, I can't remember if it was fall of 68, probably, when I came back in again. I'm not really sure.
Okay. And then you ended.
But in 69, like 69 is when I, June 1st, 69 is when I started working at the Capital Times full time.
Okay.
So.
Okay. So while you were a student here, did you take part in the protest movement that was going on?
Yes. I actually lived at the corner of University and Park Street over what was Chole's Floral Shop at the time. It's now Vilas Communications Hall. There's actually a bus stop at in front of Wireless Communications Hall. And participated in a sit-in at the administration building in 65. And then covered the Black Strike, actually, just personally had a perfect vantage point of the National Guard going down the street at the University and Park. That was pretty much when I first started taking photographs. And I just kind of mushroomed from there.
So during the Black Strike, you were taking pictures as a, I guess I'd say an amateur photographer. You weren't associated with any, either student newspaper or any other?
Right, I was just on my own, totally just shooting for myself. I'm looking at contact sheets at the moment, and which I went through this morning and tried to get everything in chronological order. But these were, that was February of 69.
Okay.
And it was a big deal. There were, you know, National Guard was on campus, lots of police, you know, major, lots of arrests, you know, a lot of things happening. It went on from there to, as I'm finding these, in April of 69, Father Graffi took over the Capitol with a bunch of welfare demonstrators, and that was, there were a lot of people involved in that. I was trying to figure out if the protest this past Saturday here in Madison against the, you know, the pro-union rally against Governor Walker's bill, or budget bill, if it was the biggest protest that had ever happened. There was some talk of that being the case, and looking back through my photos, I think, at least in terms of everything I was ever involved in, I think it really was the biggest by far. Mm-hmm. I couldn't remember people stretching all the way corner to corner from the State Street entrance, and, you know, all the way to the street, all the way to the buildings, and being absolutely solid people.
Right.
And looking back through my contact sheets here, I can see that was never the case. So.
Okay.
Thought that was interesting. That is just for myself.
Yeah, that is interesting. And we had mentioned before we turned on the recording that you took some photos of it would have been Saturday the 12th, March 12th. Because Monday was the 14th, the day's the 15th. So Saturday, March 12th, 2011.
Correct.
The protests there.
Yep.
All right. So, how did you find out about the job at the Cap Times?
Good question. My father was the composing room foreman at Madison Newspapers. He actually put out the State Journal. He was a typographer, basically, but he was composing room foreman for about 20 years of his 33 years that he was there. And when we went on strike October 1st, 77, I had two uncles as well. As I had been there 8 years, my father, 33, another uncle, 30-some, actually both other uncles had both been there in the 30-plus years. We had 103 years between the four of us in the newspaper plant. So it was quite a bitter time.
Mm-hmm. So your father worked for Madison Newspapers, and was he instrumental in getting you the job?
He had found out that there was an opening and called me up, said I should go interview. And at the time, I had no professional experience at all. What I had done, I was a nature photographer. I mean, that's how why I bought a camera. Is just I love taking pictures of nature and, you know, forms, textures, things that you know, interested me visually. And I really didn't photograph people much. And I was involved in a group called Measure for Measure that raised money and food and clothing to take to poor, rural, primarily blacks in Bolivar County and Mississippi. And actually had Christmas dinner with Fannie Lou Hamer in her home, that was a pretty, very cool experience. And that trip where I photographed like crazy, but again, I was just an early amateur at that point. Obviously, still have the negatives. And from the strength of those people photos, that's the only people pictures I had to show Elliot Marinus at the time was the person who actually hired me, and whose son has since won a couple Pulitzers. Elliot, you know, great editor. Dave Zweifel was the city editor, and but I got the job and started June 1st, 1969.
Was there any concern that getting a job and leaving school would make you, I guess not if you'd already been in the military, you didn't have to worry about being in the military.
Right.
Yep. So.
Yeah, it was that, and that was, it was just, it's a weird combination of events, but it worked out in the end for me.
What was your decision process in deciding to take the job and to quit school?
Well, I really did love photography. I was shooting a roll of film every day, developing it in my kitchen, which my whole apartment was not a lot bigger than this room that we're in at the moment. Mm-hmm. And my bathroom was like tiny, and that's where I had to load the film and develop, you know, put it in the tanks and things. But and then I had a enlarger and developed contact sheets and made small prints in my kitchen in that apartment with my wife at the time. And I just really loved photography. And then when I was able to get a job at the newspaper, that was, you know, it was like a dream job. Mm-hmm. I mean, wasn't even on my radar until my father called me up. And he had nothing to do with getting the job other than that they respected him. And so that's how I got the interview, at least. But on the strength of meeting me, and they could see that I had potential. And, you know, from there I took off. I ended up winning numerous awards. I was nominated for Pulitzer Prize in 76 from the pictures in here of during that was presidential campaign year. This series of pictures was nominated for a Pulitzer when Senator Henry Jackson from the state of Washington was spit on by Ben Mazel here at the airport. And there was a big federal trial of him after that. And it's an interesting combination. Ben Mazel's still around, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. And I was told by someone who was at the judging that year that was the runner-up photo, that it was basically second place, but they don't ever announce that. But it was somebody who was actually at the judging. And picture of an African-American man being rammed with an American flag taken by Stanley Forman won that year. Hmm. So,
wow.
Yeah, interesting times.
Right. I really want to ask about the mechanics of processing film, because it's so different now in the 21st century. So we may hold that and get back to it, because, and first off, we're in a room that's, you know, maybe 15 by 15. And so your apartment was small.
It was tiny. It was
and
really
one,
small.
One tiny part of it was used as basically your film studio.
Well, it was my kitchen. I mean, our kitchen and my bathroom. That's in the bathroom, truly, it was about 3 by 6 or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally, and the kitchen was probably 4 by 8, maybe. And then there was a tiny bedroom. Yeah, so the whole place might have been half again bigger than this room, but it's not much, if that, mm-hmm. kind of in the living room and the bedroom.
Sure.
Yeah, and I, you know, when I say I really fell in love with photography, I'm not kidding, because once I was at the Capital Times in 72, I paid privately and studied with Ansel Adams for 10 days with a workshop in Yosemite Valley. And that was a great time.
And I'm sorry, what time period was
it? It was in the fall of 72, so September 72.
Okay, so this was actually...
I'd been a newspaper
been
photographer,
a professional photographer
three years by then.
Okay.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I had to threaten to quit the newspaper in order to go to the workshop. My boss at the time wouldn't give me the time off. I'd had to take a week of vacation that year to deal with an alcoholic mother-in-law who needed serious help getting into recovery, and but did do that. She ended up going on and becoming an alcohol and drug abuse counselor for the next 20 years after that. So, but I was short a week of vacation, and I was driving to Yosemite with my wife and her two sisters to go along, and it was a 10-day workshop, and I had to drive to Yosemite and back in my Volkswagen bus. There's no way I could do it in 2 weeks. So, mm-hmm. Checked with Elliot Marinus, Dave Zweifel, all the other editors, absolutely you should be able to go, but he's the boss. Dave Sandell was his name, was my boss. And reporters had taken 6 months to go to South America, a year to go to Europe, whatever, no problem, and they still had their jobs. I wanted 1 week without pay to study with Ansel Adams, and he said, Ansel Adams, what does he know about photography? Yeah, this is BS. Well, forget it. It ain't going to happen. So literally came the day I was had to leave in order to get there in time. And he said, I said, you know, Dave, well, what's it going to be? He said, well, I guess you don't go. And I said, well, you know what? F you. I quit. And I turned to walk away. And he started to stutter and literally turn green. And he said, oh, okay, you can take a week off next year's vacation. I said, fine, you. And I left. I just walked out the door and like was back after the workshop. But and I had won a bunch of awards by then. It was, you know, Wisconsin Photographer or Second Place Photographer of the Year, you know, Madison Photographer of the Year, a couple, 3 years running, and, you know, had total respect of all my other, you know, at the State Journal photographers. And he was just, I don't know how to describe what it was, but he vowed he'd never hire somebody better than him again. Mm-hmm. He just couldn't deal with it. Mm-hmm. So... anyway,
we could ask questions, or I could ask questions for hours. I think based on what you said.
Oh, I'm sure.
Doesn't even involve. Yeah, what we have. There is one thing I want to ask before we get into the photos you took as a professional photographer about the student protest, and I'm just wondering if you remember what your first professional photo job was. Or an early one that stands out.
Gosh. Well, that's a really good question. Sterling Hall was one of the earliest ones, because I started in June, and that Sterling Hall happened in August. Mm-hmm. And we're talking 40-plus years ago now.
Right.
More than that. 69, 70, yeah.
But
like 42 years.
But you started in, you said you started in 69, right?
Right.
And Sterling Hall was August of 70.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right.
I mean, the TA strike, which we may actually probably get to. So let's, why don't we, it looks,
good
I think
point.
The TA strike might have been your first.
I'm a year off. Good point.
So it sounds like the TA strike, as far as.
Yeah, that TA strike was in 70.
Yep, that was the spring of 70.
Yeah, and in 69, but these pictures I have, no, actually the TA started, I've got some here from September of 69. And Grappi was. April. Yeah, the black strike is the one that I first shot for myself.
Right.
That was in February of 69. Yeah, the TA strike would have been in the GE demonstration. So yeah, the cycle here of what I've got are the TA strike, Veterans Day, major protests against the war at that point around the Capitol. Mm. Then the GE demonstrations, that was February 12th of 70. Shots here of cars overturned on campus, or a car overturned, and, you know, tear gas in the streets. That was a pretty intense time in itself. And it looks like I've got that going through March of 70. And here's one of April still of 70. Then we go into the, when Kent State happened, and these are other pictures that you may or may not have seen.
So this is a picture of Bascom shot from the bottom
of the hill.
Looks like
from
across
State
the street.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Somewhere on State Street, maybe even on those.
Right in the corner of Humanities and State Street. Mm-hmm.
Shooting up from so you can see Bascom and you see.
And it was solid. It was solid people. The first frame has solid people. Mm-hmm. The whole hill was solid people. And then
it's just people running in all directions
as tear gas started to get loud,
and you can see the smoke of the tear gas.
Yeah, and then this guy was arrested that day.
So those pictures are from the protests involving Cambodia and Kent State.
Exactly. Yep. Okay. And it was May 5th of 1970, and that day I was hit in the brick. I had just gotten some brand new Nikon. I don't know if they were F2s or just Fs in those days, but the motor drives, brand new motor drives, a couple of them, and a brick. That'll sound good. I got hit in the chest with a brick, and then I came back and told Zweifel about it. And he said, "Ah," I said, "they almost wrecked my brand new cameras." And he said, "Oh, forget your cameras. That's only a foot from your eyes. Forget it. We're not going down there anymore. It's just too crazy." I mean, they literally said, we're not going in close anymore for any of the demonstrations. It really was getting violent at that point. And that's what really sets up in terms of the context of how things were happening around here.
So we're flipping through some more context sheets.
Yeah, well, and this is just for me in terms of time frame. Then there was this rally, the silent majority. It's almost in a way this like the Tea Party now. Mm-hmm. They had their own demonstration at the federal building and the federal courthouse right across from the city county building here in Madison. And there's pictures here from that. And of course the Vietnam protesters were across the street and mixed in as part of it. And then...
So that must be in the silent majority rally. It must be in the summer, spring, summer?
Yeah, I'm having a hard time.
Because it looks like we go from the Kent State, Cambodia stuff. And of course, if you're taken off the scene, so to speak, of campus, then we probably wouldn't get anything.
Yeah, this is April 27th of 70.
Okay.
Yeah, and the Kent State was April 5th. Of 70.
Right.
So, you know, things were heated up.
April, May.
I mean, really getting hot at that point. And then it was August 24th,
mm-hmm.
was the Sterling Hall. So, at that point, I'd moved, actually, once I got a job at the Capital Times, moved from Park Street to Rutledge Street on the east side, had an apartment on Lake Monona. And, at 3 o'clock, and I bought my first car. I had a Volkswagen Beetle because I'd been on motorcycles from high school on through there. I'd put 50,000 miles on motorcycles before I owned a car. And at 3 a.m, got a phone call from Dave Zweifel. Said they blew up Sterling Hall, and I said, "Who's they?" He said, "I don't know. Just get there as fast as you can." So I jumped in my Beetle. Was going down Williamson Street literally at 60 miles an hour because it's 3 a.m, there's no other traffic. I figured all the police are going to be on campus. And went down University Avenue and roughly where the footbridge that goes over between Humanities and Bylis, I guess, now. Right about there in the middle of the road was a chunk of concrete about 8 feet long and probably a foot and a half square. Holy crap, they really did blow up Sterling Hall. And this is, should have backtracked earlier, should have mentioned this. So when I was working at the computing center, I operated computers that were on the third and the fifth floor of Sterling Hall. Mm-hmm. And I worked the weekend shift, so I was there from 8 a.m. till 8 a.m. I was there from 8 p.m. till 8 a.m. So I did like a 12-hour night shift. At that time, this is before we were in the other building. Mm-hmm. But so that was in that building. And then Army Math Research Center, which was the target, was on the sixth floor above us. And so when I got there that morning, as far as I know, I was the first photographer to arrive. And it was chaos. And it was really hard to deal with because I had been, you know, it could have been me in that building had I still been working there. Mm-hmm. And I knew nothing about, you know, what was behind it other than, well, actually even at that point, I had no idea what it was about, why it had blown up mm-hmm. or been blown up. So it was just a very intense time. And, you know, I was photographed the police bringing out Robert Fosnick's body. It was draped, but, you know, on a gurney and the expressions on their faces, which I don't know if you've ever seen that shot.
Flipping into those specific prints.
This, if you look at the expressions on these guys.
Oh, yeah. So what we have is, looks like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 police officers and 2 firefighters. And they have Robert Fosnack's body on the gurney. It's covered in a sheet. And they're looks like they're trying to get him in the back of the ambulance. Yeah, the ambulance, like a station wagon ambulance.
Yeah,
and their faces are, I think it's the last thing in the world they want to be doing right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was pretty devastating. And then this, you know, these were in the daytime later. That night, you know, as daylight, you know, kept shooting, there were some flames in the upper windows when I was there. Which you can see in the contact sheets, the prints I'm showing you now don't have those, but these are the daytime shots that show, mm-hmm. you know, and this was third floor here, so this is where I would have been working. Actually, could have even been here.
So you got a picture of the front.
And then the fifth floor would have been here, which is where I've been. This would have been Army Math at the top. Mm-hmm. Actually, this is the side. This would be the south side of the building.
Okay.
Chemistry is at my back. The front of the building is over here.
Charter Street
is mm-hmm. over here. And then this, you know, gets some idea of the devastation that was in there. And it truly was amazing. So after all the initial pictures I did, I ran back to the paper, processed them, printed them, got them out for the first editions, early edition. And then we didn't have any pictures of Robert Fasnacht yet. So I went back and then into the chemistry building. Someone came up with a photo of him, which this image is the one that I photographed the picture, and this is the one that everybody has seen, you know, around the world, because that's the only image that was done of that.
Right, the picture of the picture.
Yeah. So, very sad loss.
Right. So you took several rolls of film first thing, and then went back and got whatever you, including that picture of Fasnacht, because it was taken during that sequence. Went back, got it developed.
Well, this would be the second. I'm pretty sure the Fasnacht picture came after the first round.
The Fasnacht picture where he's covered in the gurney, or the
no, the gurney one was the first round, and then after I went back to the paper, processed that and the early images of the building, then came back separately to get the picture of Fasnacht, and then also shot Sterling from the upper levels of chemistry and stuff like that, because prior to that I had no access to it. So.
You've talked about this briefly in mentioning that you worked in that building. So it sounds like it was difficult for you to be Bruce the photographer and then Bruce the sort of former student who trying to balance those emotions when you're trying to do your job.
Yeah, it was a very emotional time. And plus, we'd never seen anything of that scale before, and even, you know, anywhere around here, that's for sure. In fact, in the country, I don't think anything had ever occurred like that prior to that. So.
Did you get called to do any photos of things like the funeral or anything like that?
No, we didn't. I think we stayed away from that. I'm sure we just, you know, let them have their privacy with that at that time. I mean, today probably they'd probably be trying to cover it. I don't know. It's hard to say anymore. Mm-hmm. But I'm pretty sure at the time it was devastating enough that, and the war was still going on. I mean, that was the whole, you know, once we found out about the, you know, what it was about. And I don't even remember the timeline of, you know, how long it took before, you know, the reasoning behind it came out. There's like three different books that relate to the bombing, or where it's brought up, and one of them was RADS. I don't know if you've heard that. That's occurred yet, but have you? And then this Michael Morris book.
I've heard of the Michael Morris book, but I've never actually read.
Okay,
read it.
And then there's a third one. That this was sort of privately published. That's actually my shot on the cover of that one.
Okay, and that's
you still can't get this one.
Events of the Day.
By Richard Swanson.
Okay.
Yeah, Events of the Day by Richard Swanson. A Tragedy of the American 60s. So Events of the Day, A Tragedy of the American 60s. It wasn't easy to find. I looked these up last night because I realized I came across some invoices from some of the images that were used for these books, and I realized, you know, I have no idea if they ever got into more printings or how many they sold, if, you know, whatever, how popular they ended up being. And
So all three of those books have pictures that you took? Is that?
I think so. The Morris one, I'm not so sure about. What's interesting about his book, And this would be this will likely be, I suspect, new information for you. And this is why it was interesting for me going through all these contacts in this, and once I put them in sequential order. I believe it was in Michael Morris came to my home and looked through these contact sheets. Mm-hmm. And the reason Carl Armstrong was extradited from Canada is because they couldn't prove that if they could prove that it was a political act, he would not have been extradited. Mm-hmm. But nobody could find any photos that could prove that he was ever demonstrated against the war prior to the bombing. Mm. And Morris, going through my negatives, or not through the negatives, but through the proofs, found this. And one of these people, he said, is Carl Armstrong. So had his attorney found that, and I brought a loop if you want to try to look and see. I don't know if you've seen many pictures of him or not. If it's true, yeah, here's a loop you can try to see with that. I don't know if you'll be able to, you'll need to get some light on it, probably just hold it up sideways so you get some light.
So I'm looking at a contact sheet.
Yeah, and that's the west end of Sterling Hall. The end that faces the Capitol, I guess would be the best way to describe it, the narrow end of the building. Opposite of Charter, that's that entrance. And there are protesters, anti-war protesters, with some signs and, you know, maybe, I don't know, the half a dozen people, something like that. And he thought that one of those, or he seemed quite sure, mm-hmm. that one of those was Carl.
Huh. So I guess I haven't seen enough pictures of Carl as a young man to...
That's the problem, neither have I.
...to know for sure. That's very interesting, though. So just to get on the recording, we're looking at one of your contact sheets that you put together for this, and on this contact sheet there's a series of three pictures of five folks protesting. And a few of them have signs.
And it's on the steps of Sterling Hall.
Right, because you see the mathematics.
The AMRC
yeah.
logo
you
or
can
the
see
lettering.
You can see the lettering.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's an interesting, this is something nobody else knows about. And I don't know if it's in his book, because I never got a copy of his book, so mm-hmm. I don't know the answer to that one. I just thought it was interesting.
Yeah, that's very interesting. go ahead if you have other things you want.
Well, what's really strange is I did a wedding. I'm at maximum a dozen weddings a year since my daughter's 13 now. Like the year before she was born, I started doing weddings and had never done them for money, at least in my career prior to that. And but one of the weddings I did maybe 5 years ago, thereabouts, Carl Armstrong was the uncle of the bride, and he was at the wedding. So after we'd done the whole wedding and the reception had been going on for hours and hours, eventually you kind of hit a wall on what else you can photograph. And so we got talking, and you know, I explained that I'd been there. And I can describe him as sort of a gentle giant. I mean, he's a really large man. Mm-hmm. And he just still, you know, obviously feels horrible about the death of Fasnacht. I mean, their act, you know, I think they still believe it was the right thing to do, but the death of Fasnacht, they, you know, they placed the phone call, they tried to make sure nothing like that happened. They didn't expect anybody to be in the building, and with the warning they put out, they thought, you know, that would solve that problem. But mm-hmm. he described being at the corner of Park and Dayton, facing a police car. This is after they left the van, set the charge of the timer, whatever it was they used, mm-hmm. and they're at Park and Dayton, and there's a squad car facing them when the bomb went off, and it literally lifted their cars off the ground, and the cop's eyes just, you know, huge, and they put that siren on and went flying right past them, and they turned right and headed out of town. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, his description of that moment was so real for him still. You could tell in the way he talked about Fasnacht that it was just still haunts him to this day, I'm sure.
It's
So,
as someone who you said earlier that you were against the war, once you found out what the motivations were, how did it affect you personally?
Well, I mean, I think it's way too extreme an act to voice that or to kind of get the point across. But I'd like to think that it actually did make a difference, at least bringing the severity of all of it home in some ways. I mean, I don't know how to describe it. It's just I'd like to not think it was a senseless act, that it had no meaning, mm-hmm. and especially with someone dying, with Vosnak dying, and the other people that were injured. There's another person that was injured that I didn't even know about till recently, reading stories about it. Mm-hmm. I would just like to hope that it made a difference, but who knows?
Did you follow or take any pictures of? Well, first off, I'll start this way. Did you follow the trial, the extradition, and then the trial here?
Definitely followed it. We didn't shoot much around it for the paper, but I did notice in going back through these. So after the bombing, as we get there, there was a Free Carl rally on campus. Mm-hmm. And along with other peace vigils. I mean, the protests went on. I've still got another set of protests here going on through 72. I don't even remember when the war actually did end. I'm not good with remembering that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I do have, there are definitely pictures in here from the Free Carl rally that was held on the Library Mall.
Okay. And you have a date? Do you have a date on that?
Yeah.
Of course, it's
May 4th, 1972.
Okay. Yeah, that would make sense.
Okay. You can see the Free Carl.
Right. So, looking at another contact sheet from May 4th, 1972. And there's the steps of Memorial Library. A fair amount of people there.
Yeah, it was full. It was solid. That whole lower end of, that whole end of the mall was, or the whole mall itself was full, mm-hmm. for sure. And it was, sort of a big party in a way.
Right.
I think they had a band and other stuff. I can't remember.
So you talk about getting, I want to back up just a touch to ask one more question about that, and then
sure.
maybe ask again some of the questions about some more of the stuff in the 70s, particularly the strike. You talk about getting hit with a brick. As a member of the media, how do you feel you were treated?
Good question, because there's the other side of that. It wasn't the brick alone that made the editor say we're not going back down there. Mm-hmm. Was in addition to getting hit with a brick, I was also tear gassed, and not just like randomly around. I mean, it was aimed at me, and it was my feet. The police didn't want us there either, mm-hmm. and trying to be, because it was really intense time. Them and they were. I don't think they were trained for that kind of stuff at that point yet. At least not here. And there were a lot of police brought in from out of town as well, because there were. I can remember this gigantic African American guy from Milwaukee police. I mean, mm-hmm. this is not somebody I would want to mess with ever. Mm-hmm. And being concerned at the time. I was never hit or abused by the police at that point. But getting hit by brick by the students. Not thinking I'm their enemy, which mm-hmm. was ridiculous. What we were doing was helping the cause immensely. But obviously not everybody's rational at that point, and especially if they're getting tear gassed. And that was one of the, wasn't the first time gas had been used, but it was. There were lots of canisters lobbed in there that day. When you look at those pictures, I think you can count like seven different ones in mm-hmm. that one scene alone. or that one moment in time in that scene. That was an interesting challenge, but always, you know, learning to work around police, fire, emergency personnel. I mean, when I first got there, I'm thinking, where am I going to be? How can I get anywhere where I can get any photos? And you know, I worked my way basically around the entire crowd pretty much and through it two different directions. Slowly, it was like a minnow swimming in a school of fish, only swimming the wrong direction in order to, you know, logistically work through. And you know, everybody was very polite and amazingly so. It was great energy there. But eventually I was able to work my way back to a corner and also thinking about the light itself. Ended up finding a trash can I could stand on next to a stop in the corner of State Street in the Capitol and got a great vantage point where I could see all the way up the staircase to the Capitol and photograph the whole thing. Plus be high enough to be over the crowd. Could see the scale of how many people were there, and the next day's Sunday's paper had the view from directly over what had been over my head on the roof of the Historical Society, mm-hmm. And that would have been another vantage point to have had. I would love to have gotten up there, and mm-hmm. I probably could have talked my way up, but I didn't really think of it at the time because it was all happening, and you know there was no time to do it at that point.
Right.
So, yeah. Pleased with what I got.
Did you, so part of what went on, the time you got bricked, part of the Kent State and Cambodia protests were firebombs around the city, not just on campus, including a Kroger's that got firebombed. I'm wondering if
yeah, and that was close to where I used to live. At my very first apartment was at 435 West Dayton, so you know, not even a block from there.
What did you, photograph any of that?
I didn't. They happened at like, you know, at times of the night or whenever when just wasn't working or didn't know about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. On lots of other, you know, smashed glass, broken windows, trashed up and down West Washington and State Street and stuff. But
sure.
And there's some of that in these proofs. But
sure.
But never any actual firebombing.
One more thing about one of the events that went on during campus, and I think you may have been, well, I'll ask, the second Dow 2, or what they call the Dow Riot or the Dow Protest, which was October of 67. It sounds like that may have been during your high
school. That's when I was in the Navy, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, or I know I wasn't on campus at that time, so it had to be when I was like either boot camp or on my carrier, is my guess.
Okay.
Yeah, I've seen plenty of pictures from that time taken by other photographers.
Did you, coming here today and preparing, is there anything else you wanted to say or perhaps show about specifically about the student protest, either your personal involvement or your professional involvement in it?
Boy, good question. Well, as a freshman, having the, you know, during the Black Strike, having National Guard people literally marching outside my window, I mean, it was just really bizarre. I mean, having been to Mississippi, and this is, you know, it was a pretty tumultuous time in general, but to have the Guard in the street here in town was pretty frightening in itself. And, you know, it was, you know, luckily nothing major happened because of it, like Kent State, but it was just very strange. And but clearly if people didn't speak up, you know, I mean, would the war have ever ended? Who knows? And seeing this past weekend, seeing everybody up at the Capitol, just kind of, and whipping through these last night and this morning, seeing the context of students and people, whether they were welfare people were doing Father Grappi's thing, or the Black Strike, or the TA strike, whatever, have seen people standing up for their rights or what they thought was correct or right, was really important. And I'm just hoping that this last weekend and what's going on in here in the state right now is going to change. You know, the way they're ramrodding, you know, there's no question budgetary things have to happen, but to ramrod everything through with no thought of people's rights, and you know, they're saying Fitzgerald today they're not, the Democrats can't vote, their votes don't count now until April 5th. That's, I mean, that's the whole scene is getting more frightening by the day. And I don't doubt that if things don't change, that eventually we'll see people back in the streets again, not just around here, but you know, the disparity of incomes and the tax policies, the things that are happening in this country. I mean, eventually people really are going to take to the street. They won't have any choice. And I'd like not to come to that. So
I did want to ask you, because I think it behooves me as a historian, or I would get chided by future generations if I didn't ask sort of the comparisons about what has happened over the last month. It sounds like in your answers to some of these questions, you have touched on it. So it sounds like it's something that you have consciously thought about and compared as you were getting ready to talk to us today about student protest and what's going on in the Capitol since Valentine's Day, so for the last month.
Well, yeah, and the irony is I just had cataract surgery a month ago today in my right eye. I have one good eye. And then my left eye was done a week later. But I had to be at the clinic at 6:15 in the morning. The day before, on Monday the 14th, I got a call from AFSCME in Washington wanting me to go cover the protests that were going to happen the next day. And I had to turn it down because I'd already canceled on the surgeon twice for shoots I had in Baltimore and Boise, Idaho. And that was really hard, and it may not have been the best decision to make because my eyes weren't like desperately waiting for surgery. So it just was a time that I could block out a bunch of time to make it happen. So it didn't seem fair to the surgeon to cut him off again after doing it twice already. So that's the one thing I do regret, not having covered it from the beginning, because that would have been even more interesting. And it's the first major protest sort of thing I've missed since the 60s. Mm-hmm. That's why I was. But it's also surprising to me that something like this hasn't happened before this. You know, as a historian, I'd love to know from your perspective, am I just forgetting things in between? I mean, there's the fact that there's been no serious protests. I mean, there've been some, but you know, the crosses they put along Monona Drive about the Iraq War and Afghanistan. But short of that, there's just been no major protests against the wars going on. Everybody's, you know, most people seem to be against them, and yet they go on and nothing's happening. And I don't know if the mobilization, as it were, that occurred Saturday and has been going on for a month, well, if that'll extend into, you know, if we ended those wars, the budget wouldn't be an issue anymore. The money that's being spent over there and the people being killed, which is much more important. But, you know, it all doesn't make sense to me. And I'd sure love to see it stop and have a much saner world if that were possible. But you know, the unrest we've seen in Egypt and Libya, which unfortunately looks like it's going backwards now. But seems hope that for the world in terms of democracy taking over, the dictators not controlling, but what Washington it's not on the same level, obviously, but it sure is leading it like one. It's not leading like a governor that's, you know, looking for consensus or for, you know, any discussion between people. He's got his way and screw everybody else. He really doesn't care. And I think the whole Republican Party, it's pretty clear. You know, when Obama got elected, there was great hope for things to change. And when the Republicans refused to positively, you know, enact anything that he pushed forward, well, of course people got unhappy, and but they weren't, most people I'm sure weren't aware or thinking far enough ahead to realize that by switching and shift and voting for the Republicans, thinking they're going to get a change that's going to help them, you know, it's you know, just backfiring in reverse, and it's this whole country's becoming more and more polarized, and the income disparity is so much greater. Yeah, I mean it'll go on for a while, but I don't see how it could go on for real long.
Well, so, I want to ask about another uplifting topic. We found out either off the recording or just as you started that you were you ended your time at the Capital Times because you went on strike. Wondering if you would mind talking about that.
Well, a strike, that was probably the most bitter time of my life in terms of it's part of the reason this whole protest that's gone on for the last month. I didn't go up until Saturday for a couple reasons. One, just physically in terms of my surgery and my eyes, I didn't want to risk anything major happening to them. But I knew from the strike in 77 against Madison newspapers and the Cap Times and the State Journal that, I know how much I was screaming on the picket line. Mm-hmm. and talk about blood pressure rising and, you know, an intensity of emotion and feeling, and having covered other strikes, I didn't think I could hold it, and I didn't want to get arrested being up at the Capitol. That's what it boils down to, because I knew if I had run into a Tea Party person, I probably would not have done well with that, because I feel much too strongly about it, and I have a good temper when pushed, and I just chose not to do that, and I know I'll definitely be more involved now in the future as well. But the Cap Times, the strike went on for, my union settled 3 years later, my father's union was 5 years later. The irony there was my one of the major things the strike was over was the computerized typesetting came in, and they wanted to drop all the typographers, drop their pay to $5 an hour or whatever it was, and huge pay cuts, and not retrain them to do anything else. And the irony was, after the strike, my father ended up getting hired by the state of Wisconsin to be the head of their computerized typesetting, and he knew nothing about computers, but he was a really good supervisor, and he really knew about printing, so that's where he retired from. And, but literally, our union settled 3 years later, theirs was 5 years later, and nobody won except the newspapers, of course. And when they built the plant on Fish Hatchery Road, because the newspaper used to be downtown, right behind Anchor Savings and Loan, it's still a driveway, I think, or a parking lot, but there was a four-story building there. That was Madison newspapers, and it was right across the street. It's on the same block as Anchor, but right across the street from the city county building, so the police station and everything. I mean, it couldn't have been in a better place for covering the government, you know, the capital, the state government, and the local government. But when they built the newspaper plant on Fish Hatchery, it was built for a strike. They had 4 months of newsprint inside the gates of the plant, you know, barbed wire, gated, huge fence and railroad siding inside the gate. So there was no way they were going to miss a day of publication, and Lee Enterprises, you know, owned the State Journal. So they're in Davenport, Iowa. So the first night of the strike, cars just poured through from Iowa, and they never missed a day of publication. So we started our own strike paper, The Press Connection, and 6 weeks before the strike, I bought a house on Lake Monona, literally on Lake Monona, right at the mouth of the Uhura River. The last house on Morrison Street, magnificent home built by a banker in 1928. It's a three-story brick, wonderful home. And after 4 years of tearing, gutting the house and trying to start a business from scratch, I got divorced after 14 years of marriage to my high school sweetheart. And life is different now. I have a 13-year-old daughter and been married 25 years this June. So, you know, it's a wouldn't have a daughter had I not done that. So that's a cool thing. Mm-hmm. But the strike was just, it was a very, very difficult time. It changed a lot of people's lives. And I doubt there's anybody that remembers it fondly. You know, so it's the idea of, you know, what all the unions are protesting about with taking away bargaining rights. And I mean, I don't think anybody that's ever been on strike wants to go on strike again. You know, it's a usually a no-win situation. And I mean, management usually wins. But had there not been any unions at all, you know, we would be working. You know, when I talked about when I got a job at the paper, you know, I was in the union, and I had issues with the union in terms of people being protected that had no business having a job still, and had to work around that multiple times as well. And but I also heard from the old timers, you know, that used to work 7 days a week and ridiculous hours, you know, whenever they were told to be there, why it was important. So, and eventually we'll end up, you know, in China they're working, the people that are making the iPhones, they work 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what you have without a union. And the people that are against unions now, I mean, the ads that are on TV right now for the whole, you know, supporting the Republicans right now are just so maddening. There's new ones almost every day, literally. Between watching the horror that's happening in Japan, seeing these ads here locally that are just outright lies, it's just really maddening. You know, blaming the unions for everything, and people don't understand is they wouldn't have a normal 40-hour work week had there not been unions making that happen. So, yeah.
Bruce, is there anything else you want to say either about the student protest movement, Sterling Hall, or anything else?
Well, in terms of being against the war or wars in general, when I was in high school, girlfriend Jan Salek and I went out in the middle of Lake Monona, and our homes in Monona were on a flight path, the big jets. And we shoveled out in the wintertime a giant, it was like 150-foot diameter peace symbol, so all the planes flying into Madison would
look right over it.
So that was our first protest.
Well, Bruce, I want to thank you very much for coming today.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I do appreciate it.